What will we do to protect our family? The horn sounded, and the players took the field. Every parent now checked to see whether his or her kid was still in the game. Thomas was. Becky continued to talk. Corinne quieted now, nodding along, but she kept her focus on Thomas. Corinne was good with focus. Adam had originally loved that quality in his wife. Corinne knew what she wanted from life, and she could laser in on the goals that would help achieve it. When they met, Adam had fuzzy future plans at best, something about working with the underserved and downtrodden, but he had no specifics about where he wanted to live or what kind of life he wanted to lead or how to form that life or that nuclear family. It was all vast and vague to him, and here, in stark contrast, was this spectacular, beautiful, intelligent woman who knew exactly what they both should do. There was a freedom in that surrender. It was then, thinking about the decisions, or lack thereof, he had made to get him to this point in life. When Thomas got the ball behind the goal, faked a pass down the middle, drove to the right, cranked back his stick, and shot a beauty low and in the corner. Goal. The fathers and mothers cheered. Thomas's teammates came over and congratulated him, slapping him good-naturedly on the helmet. His son stayed calm, following that old adage, "Act like you've been there." But even at this distance, even through his son's face mask, even behind the mouth guard, Adam knew that Thomas, his oldest child, was smiling, that he was happy, that it was Adam's job as a father first and foremost to keep that boy and his brother smiling and happy and safe. What would he do to keep his boys happy and safe? Anything. But it wasn't all about what you do or sacrifice, was it? Life was also about luck, about randomness, about chaos. So he could and would do whatever was possible to protect his children. But he somehow knew with absolute certainty, that it wouldn't be enough, that luck, randomness, and chaos had other plans, that the happiness and safety were going to dissolve in the still springtime air. Chapter 7 Thomas ended up scoring his second goal, the game winner, with fewer than 20 seconds on the clock. This was the hypocrisy in Adam's cynicism about the overly intense sports world. Despite everything, when Thomas scored that final goal, Adam leapt in the air, pumped his fist, and shouted, "Yes!" Like it or not, he felt a rush of pure, undiluted joy. His better angels would say that it had nothing to do with Adam himself, that the joy emanated from the knowledge that his son was feeling even greater joy, and that it was natural and healthy for a parent to feel that way for his own child. Adam reminded himself that he was not one of those parents who lived through his kids or looked at lacrosse as a ticket to a better college. He enjoyed the sport for one simple reason. His sons loved playing. But parents all tell themselves a lot of things. The Croatian hunchback, right? When the game ended, Corinne took Ryan home in her car. She was going to get dinner ready. Adam waited for Thomas in the Cedarfield High School parking lot. It would, of course, have been much easier to simply take him home right after the game, but there were rules about the kids taking the team bus for insurance purposes. So Adam, along with a bunch of other parents, followed the bus back to Cedarfield and waited for their sons to disembark. He got out of his car and made his way toward the school's back entrance. "Hey, Adam." Cal Gottsman walked toward him. Adam said hey back. The two fathers shook hands. "Great win," Cal said. "Yes, indeed. Thomas played a hell of a game." "So did Eric." Cal's glasses never seemed to fit right. They kept slipping down his nose, forcing him to push them back up with his index finger, only to have them immediately start their nasal descent again.
You seemed distracted."
"Pardon?"
"At the game," Cal said.
He had one of those voices where everything sounded like a whine. "You seemed, I don't know, bothered?"
"Did I?"
"Yes."
He pushed the glasses up his nose. "I also couldn't help but notice your look of, shall we say, disgust?"
"I'm not sure what..."
"When I was correcting the referees."
"Correcting," Adam thought.
but he didn't want to get into that.
I didn't even notice.
You should have. The ref was going to call a cross-check on Thomas when he got the ball at X.
Adam made a face.
I'm not following.
I ride the refs,
Cal said in a conspiratorial tone.
With purpose. You should appreciate that. It benefited your son tonight.
Right, Adam said.
Then, because who the hell was this guy to approach him like this? He added. And why do we sign that sportsmanship waiver at the beginning of the season?
Which one?
The one where we promise not to verbally abuse any players, coaches, or referees, Adam said.
That one.
You're being naive, Cal said. Do you know who Moskowitz is?
Does he live on Spencer Place? Trades bonds?
No,
Cal replied with an impatient snap.
Professor Tobias Moskowitz at the University of Chicago.
No.
57%.
What?
Studies show that 57% of the time, the home team wins a sporting event, what we call a home field advantage.
So?
So, the home field advantage is real. It exists. It exists across all sports, during all time periods and all geographies. Professor Moskowitz noted that it is remarkably consistent.
Adam said, so? Again.
Now, you probably heard many of the normal reasons given to explain this advantage. Travel, fatigue, the away team has to go on a bus or a plane or what have you. Or maybe you've heard that it's familiarity with the playing field, or that some teams are used to cold weather or warm weather.
We live in neighboring towns, Adam said.
Right, exactly, which just strengthens my point.
Boy, was Adam not in the mood.
Where the heck was Thomas?
So, Cal continued, what do you think Moskowitz found?
Excuse me?
What do you think explains home field advantage, Adam?
I don't know, Adam said. Crowd support, maybe?
Cal Gotsman clearly liked that answer.
Yes.
And no.
Adam tried not to sigh.
Professor Moskowitz and others like him have run studies on home field advantage. They aren't saying things like travel fatigue aren't a factor, but there is pretty much no data supporting those theories, just some anecdotal evidence. No, the fact is, only one reason for the home field advantage is supported by hard, cold data.
He held up his index finger in case Adam didn't know what one meant. Then, just in case he was being too subtle, he said,
just one.
And that is?
Cal lowered the finger into a fist. Referee bias. That's it. The home team gets more of the calls.
So you're saying the refs are throwing the game?
No. See, that's the key to the study. It isn't as though the referees are purposely favoring the home team. The bias is completely unintentional. It's not conscious. It's all related to social conformity.
Cal's scientist hat was strapped down tightly now.
In short, we all want to be liked. The refs, like all humans, are all social creatures and assimilate the emotions of the crowd. Every once in a while, a referee will subconsciously make a call that will make the crowd happier. Ever watch a basketball game? All coaches work the refs because they understand human nature better than anyone. Do you see?
Adam nodded slowly.
I do.
So that's it, Adam.
Cal spread his hands.
That's the whole home field advantage in a nutshell. The human desire to conform and be liked.
And so you yell at the referees?
At away games, he interrupted. I mean, we need to keep our advantage at home, but at away games, sure. Scientifically speaking, you need it for balance. Staying quiet could actually hurt you.
Adam looked away.
What?
Nothing.
No, I want to hear it. You're an attorney, right? You work in an adversarial business.
I do.
And you do what you can to influence the judge or opposing counsel?
I do.
So?
Nothing. I got your point.
But you don't agree with it.
I don't really want to get into it.
But the data is pretty clear.
Right.
So what's your issue?
Adam hesitated and then figured, why not?
It's just a game, Cal. Home field advantage is part of it. It's why we play half of the games home, half away. So it balances out. In my view, and hey, it's only mine, you're justifying bad behavior. Let it just play out, bad calls and all. It's a better example to the boys than screaming at referees. And if we lose an extra game or two a year, which I doubt, it's a small price to pay for decorum and dignity, don't you think? Cal Gotsman started working up his counter when Thomas came out of the locker room. Adam held up a hand and said, "No big deal, Cal, just my take." "Excuse me, okay?" Adam hurried back to the car and watched his son cross the field. There is a definite walk when you feel good about a win. Thomas stood more upright, a bounce in his step. There was a hint of a smile on his face. Thomas didn't want to let that joy out, Adam knew, until he was in the car. He waved to a few friends, ever the politician. Ryan was on the quiet side, but Thomas could be mayor of this town. Thomas threw his lacrosse bag into the back seat. The stink from the much sweated-in pads began their assault. Adam slid open the windows. That did some good, but after a game in the warm weather, it was never enough. Thomas waited for them to get about a block away before allowing his face to light up.
"Did you see that first goal?"
Adam grinned.
"Sick."
"Yeah, only my second goal, using my left." It was a nice move. The game winner was sweet, too. They went on like this for quite some time. Some might think it was being boastful. It was actually the opposite. With his teammates and coaches, Thomas was modest and generous. He always gave credit to someone else, the guy who made the pass, the kid who made the steal, and grew shy and embarrassed whenever he was made the center of attention on an athletic field. But alone with his family, Thomas felt comfortable cutting loose. He loved to go into details about the game, not just about his goals, but about the entirety of play, what the other kids said, who had played well, who hadn't. Home was a secure haven for that. A familial cone of honesty, if you will. Corny as it sounded, that was what family should be. He didn't have to worry about sounding like a braggart or a phony or any of that. He just spoke freely. "He's home!" Corinne shouted as Thomas walked through the door. He shrugged his lax bag off his shoulder and left it in the mudroom. Thomas let his mother hug him.
"Great game, honey!"
"Thanks." Ryan offered his brother a fist bump of congratulations.
"What's for dinner?" Thomas asked.
"I got one of those marinated skirt steaks on the grill."
"Oh, yeah."
The steaks were Thomas's favorite. Not wanting to break the mood, Adam dutifully gave his wife a kiss. They all washed up. Ryan set the table, which meant that Thomas would have to clear it. There was water for everyone. Corinne had poured two glasses of wine for the adults. She laid out the food on the kitchen island. Everyone grabbed plates and served themselves. It was a strikingly ordinary, albeit cherished, family dinner, and yet it felt to Adam as though there were a ticking bomb under their table. It was only a matter of time now. The dinner would end, and the boys would do their homework or watch TV or mess around on the computer or play a video game. Would he wait until Thomas and Ryan went to bed? Probably. Except that over the past year or two, he or Corinne would fall asleep before Thomas. So he'd have to get Thomas in his room with the door closed before he could confront his wife with what he had learned. Tick, tick, tick. For most of the meal, Thomas held court. Ryan listened raptly. Corinne told a story about how one of the teachers got drunk in Atlantic City and threw up in the casino. The boys loved it.
"Did you win any money?"
Thomas asked.
"I never gamble," Corinne said, ever the mom,
"and you shouldn't either."
Both boys rolled their eyes.
"I'm serious, it's a terrible vice."
Now both boys shook their heads.
"What? You're so lame sometimes," Thomas said.
"I am not."
"Always with the life lesson stuff,"
Ryan added with a laugh.
"Cut it out."
Corinne looked to Adam for help.
"Do you hear your sons?"
Adam just shrugged. The subject changed. Adam didn't remember to what. He was having trouble focusing. It was as though he were watching a movie montage of his own life. The happy family he and Corinne had created, having dinner,
enjoying one another's company. He could almost see the camera slowly circling the table, getting everyone's face, getting everyone's back. It was so everyday, so hackneyed, so perfect. Tick, tick, tick. A half hour later, the kitchen was cleaned. The boys headed upstairs. As soon as they were out of sight, Corinne's smile dropped off her face. She turned to Adam.
What's wrong?
Amazing when he thought about it. He had lived with Corinne for 18 years. He had seen her in every kind of mood, had experienced her every emotion. He knew when to approach, when to stay away, when she needed a hug, when she needed a kind word. He knew her well enough to finish her sentences and even her thoughts. He knew everything about her. There had been, he thought, no surprises. He even knew her well enough to know that what the stranger had alleged was indeed possible. Yet he hadn't seen this. He hadn't realized that Corinne could read him too, that she had known, despite his best effort to hide it, that something serious had upset him, that it wasn't just a normal thing, that it was something big and maybe life-altering. Corinne stood there and waited for the blow. So he delivered it. Did you fake your pregnancy? Chapter 8. The stranger sat at a corner table at the Red Lobster in Beechwood, Ohio, just outside of Cleveland. He nursed his Red Lobster specialty cocktail, a mango Mai Tai. His garlic shrimp scampi had started to congeal into something resembling tile caulk. The waiter had tried to take it from him twice, but the stranger had shooed him away. Ingrid sat across the table. She sighed and checked her watch.
This has to be the longest lunch ever.
Stranger nodded.
Almost 2 hours.
They were watching a table with four women who were on their third specialty cocktail round, and it wasn't yet 2:30. Two of them had done Crab Fest, the variety dish served on a plate the approximate circumference of a manhole cover. The third woman had ordered the shrimp linguine Alfredo. The cream sauce kept getting caught up in the corners of her pink lipsticked mouth. The fourth woman, whose name they knew as Heidi Dan, was the reason they were there. Heidi had ordered the wood-grilled salmon. She was 49, big and bouncy with straw-like hair. She wore a tiger print top with a somewhat plunging neckline. Heidi had a boisterous yet melodic laugh. The stranger had been listening to it for the past 2 hours. There was something mesmerizing in the sound.
I've grown to like her, the stranger said.
Me too.
Ingrid pulled her blonde hair back with both hands, forming an imaginary ponytail and then letting it free. She did that a lot. She had the kind of long, too straight hair that constantly fell in front of her face.
There's a certain zest for life there, you know.
He knew exactly what Ingrid meant.
In the end, Ingrid said, we're doing her a favor.
That was the justification. The stranger agreed with it. If the foundation is rotten, you need to demolish the entire house. You can't just fix it with a coat of paint or a few planks of wood. He knew that. He understood it. He lived it. He believed it. But that didn't mean that he relished being the one to work the explosives. That was also how he looked at it. He was the one who blew up the house with the rotting foundation, but he never stuck around to see how or if it was rebuilt. He didn't even stick around to make sure that no one had been left inside the house when it went up. The waitress came over and gave the ladies the check. Everyone dug into their purses with care and produced cash. The woman who had the linguine did the math, dividing the bill up with precision. The two Crab Fest eaters pulled out bills one at a time. Then they each opened their change purse as though it were a rusted chastity belt. Heidi just threw in some 20s. Something about the way she did it, with care and ease, touched him. He guessed that the Dans were okay with money, but who knew in today's world? Heidi and her husband Marty had been married 20 years. They had 3 kids. Their oldest daughter, Kimberly, was a freshman at NYU in Manhattan. The 2 boys, Charlie and John, were still in high school.
Heidi worked various makeup counters at the Macy's in University Heights. Marty Dan was a vice president in sales and marketing for TTI Floor Care in Glen Willow. TTI was all about vacuum cleaners. They owned Hoover, Oreck, Royal, and the division where Marty had worked for the past 11 years, Dirt Devil. He traveled a lot for his job, mostly to Bentonville, Arkansas, because that was where Walmart's corporate offices were. Ingrid was studying the stranger's face. "I can handle this on my own if you like." He shook his head. This was his job. Ingrid was here because he would need to approach a woman, and that sometimes looked odd. A man and woman couple approaching someone? No worries. A man approaching another man in, say, a bar or American Legion Hall? Again, no worries. But if a 27-year-old man approached a 49-year-old woman near, say, a Red Lobster, that could get tricky. Ingrid had already paid the bill, so they moved quickly. Heidi had arrived on her own in a gray Nissan Sentra. He and Ingrid had parked their rent-a-car two spots away. They waited by the car, key in hand, ready to pretend that they were about to get in it and drive off. They didn't want to draw attention to themselves. 5 minutes later, the four women exited the restaurant. They hoped Heidi would end up alone now, but they had no way of knowing for certain. One of her friends could walk her to the car, in which case they would have to follow Heidi back to her house and either try to confront her there. Never a good idea to confront a victim on their own property. It made them more defensive. Or wait until she headed out again. The women all bid one another adieu with hugs. Heidi, he could see, was a good hugger. She hugged as though she meant it. When she hugged, her eyes closed, and the person she hugged closed hers too. It was that kind of hug. The three other women headed off in the opposite direction. Perfect. Heidi started toward her car. She wore capri pants. Her high heels made her stagger a little after the drinks, but she handled it with practiced aplomb. She was smiling. Ingrid nodded a get ready at the stranger. They both did all they could to look harmless. Heidi Dan? He tried to keep his expression friendly, or at worst, neutral. Heidi turned and met his eye. The smile dropped off her face as though someone had attached an anchor to it. She knew. He wasn't surprised. Many somehow did, though denial also worked big time when the stranger called. But he sensed strength and intelligence in her. Heidi already knew that what he was about to say would change everything. "Yes? There's a website called findyoursugarbaby.com," he said. The stranger had learned that you had to leap directly into it. You didn't ask the victim if they had time to talk or if they wanted to sit down or go someplace quiet. You just launched.
"What?"
"It purports to be a modern online dating service, but it's not. Men, supposedly wealthy men with disposable income, sign up to meet, well, sugar babies. Have you heard of it?" Heidi looked at him another second. Then she turned her gaze toward Ingrid. Ingrid tried to smile reassuringly.
"Who are you two?"
"That's not important," he said. "Some people fight it. Other people see that it's an irrelevant waste of time in the big picture." Heidi was in the latter group.
"No, I've never heard of it. It sounds like one of those sites married people use to cheat."
The stranger made a yes-no gesture with his head and said, "Not really. This site caters to more of a business transaction, if you know what I mean."
"I don't know what you mean at all," Heidi said.
"You should read the material when you have a chance. The site talks about how every relationship is really a transaction and how important it is to define your roles, to know what is expected of you, and what is expected of your lover." Heidi's face was losing color.
"Lover?"
"So here is how it works," the stranger continued. "A man signs on, for example. He looks through a list of women, usually much younger. He finds one he likes. If she accepts, they start negotiating."
"Negotiating?"
"He's looking for what we call a sugar baby. The website defines that as a woman he'd maybe take out to dinner or escort to a business conference, that kind of thing."
"But that's not what really happens."
Heidi said.
No, the stranger said. That's not what happens.
Heidi let loose a long breath. She put her hands on her hips.
Go on.
So they negotiate.
The rich guy and his sugar baby.
Right. The site tells the girl all sorts of nonsense. How everything is defined. How dating like this means no game playing. How the men are rich and sophisticated and will treat her well and buy her gifts and take her to exotic overseas locales.
Heidi shook her head.
Do the girls really fall for that?
Some, maybe, but I doubt too many. Most understand the score.
It was as though Heidi had expected him to visit, expected this news. She was calm now, though he could still sense the devastation.
So they negotiate? She prompted.
Right. Eventually they reach an understanding. It's all spelled out in an online contract. In one case, for example, the young woman agrees to be with the man 5 times per month. They spell out possible days of the week. He offers $800.
Each time?
Per month.
She?
Well, that's how it starts, but she counters with $2,000. They go back and forth.
Do they reach an agreement? Heidi asked.
Her eyes were wet now.
The stranger nodded.
In this case, they settle for $1,200 per month.
That's $14,400 per year, Heidi said with a sad smile. I'm good at math.
That's correct.
And the girl?
Heidi said.
What does she tell the guy she is?
Wait, don't tell me. She says she's a college student and needs help with her tuition.
In this case, yes.
Heidi said.
And in this case, the stranger continued, the girl is telling the truth.
She's a student?
Heidi shook her head.
Terrific.
But the girl in this case doesn't stop there, the stranger said. The girl sets up different days of the week with different sugar daddies.
Ugh, that's gross.
So with one guy, she's always Tuesdays. Another guy is Thursdays. Someone else gets weekends.
Must add up, the money, I mean.
It does.
Not to mention the venereal diseases, Heidi said.
That I can't comment on.
Meaning?
Meaning we don't know if she uses condoms or what. We don't have her medical records. We don't even know exactly what she does with all these men.
I doubt she's playing cribbage.
I doubt it too.
Why are you telling me this?
The stranger looked at Ingrid. For the first time, Ingrid spoke.
Because you deserve to know.
That's it?
That's all we can tell you, yes, the stranger said.
20 years?
Heidi shook her head and bit back her tears.
That bastard!
Pardon?
Marty, that bastard!
Oh, we're not talking about Marty, the stranger said. Now, for the first time, Heidi looked completely baffled.
What? Then who?
We're talking about your daughter, Kimberly.
Chapter 9. Corinne took the blow, stumbled back, stayed standing.
What the hell are you talking about?
Can we skip this part? Adam asked.
What?
The part where you pretend you have no idea what I'm talking about. Let's skip the denials, okay? I know you faked the pregnancy. She tried to gather herself, pick up the pieces one at a time.
If you know, why are you asking?
How about the boys? That puzzled her.
What about them?
Are they mine? Corinne's eyes went wide.
Are you out of your mind?
You faked a pregnancy. Who knows what else you're capable of? Corinne just stood there. Well?
Jesus, Adam, look at them.
He said nothing.
Of course they're yours.
There are tests, you know, DNA. You can buy them at Walgreens, for crying out loud.
Then buy them, she snapped. Those boys are yours. You know that.
They stood on either side of the kitchen island. Even now, even in the midst of his anger and confusion, he could not help but see how beautiful she was.
He couldn't believe that with all the guys who wanted her, she had somehow chosen him. Corinne was the girl men wanted to marry. That was how guys foolishly looked at women when they were younger. They broke them down into two camps. One camp made guys think of lust-filled nights and legs in the air. Camp two made them think of moonlight walks and canopies and wedding vows. Corinne was squarely in camp two. Adam's own mother had been eccentric to the point of bipolarity. That had been what foolishly attracted his father. Her crackle, Dad had explained. But the crackle turned more into mania as time passed. The crackle was fun and spontaneous, but the unpredictability wore his father down, aged him. There were great ups, but they were eventually decimated by the growing number of great downs. Adam did not make that mistake. Life is a series of reactions. His reaction to the mistake of his father was to marry a woman he considered steady, consistent, controlled, as though people were just that simple. "Talk to me," Adam said. "What makes you think I faked a pregnancy?" "The visa charge to novelty funsy," he said. "You told me it was for school decorations. It wasn't. It's a billing name for fakeapregnancy.com. She looked confused now. "I don't understand. What made you go through a charge from 2 years ago?" "It's not important." "It is to me. You didn't casually decide to start checking old bills." "Did you do it, Corinne?" Her gaze was down on the granite top of the island. Corinne had taken forever to find the exact shade of granite, finally finding something called Ontario Brown. She spotted some dried debris and started working it free with her fingernail. "Corinne, do you remember when I had two school periods off during lunch?" The change of subject threw him for a moment. "What about it?" "The debris came loose." Corinne stopped. "It was the only time in my teaching career I had that big of a time window. I got permission to go off school grounds for lunch." "I remember. I used to go to that cafe in Bookends. They made a great panini sandwich. I'd get one and a glass of homemade iced tea or a coffee. I'd sit at this corner table and read a book." A small smile came to her face. "It was bliss." Adam nodded. "Great story, Corinne. Don't be sarcastic." No, seriously, it's gripping and so relevant. I mean, I'm asking you to tell me about faking a pregnancy, but really, this story is much better. What kind of panini was your favorite, anyway? I like the turkey and Swiss myself." She closed her eyes. "You've always used sarcasm as a defense mechanism." "Oh, right, and you've always been great with timing. Like now, Corinne. Now is the time to psychoanalyze me." There was a pleading in her voice now.
"I'm trying to tell you something, okay?"
He shrugged. "So, tell me." She took a few seconds to gather herself before she began speaking again. When she did, her voice had a far-off quality to it.
"I'd go to Bookends pretty much every day, and after a while, you become, I don't know, a regular. The same people would be there all the time. It was like a community, or like Cheers. There was Jerry, who was unemployed, and Eddie was an outpatient at Bergen Pines. Debbie would bring her laptop and write..." "Corinne," she held up her hand. "And then there was Suzanne, who was, like, 8 months pregnant."
Silence.
Corinne turned behind her. "Where's that bottle of wine?"
"I don't see where you're going with this."
"I just need some more wine."
"I put it in the cabinet above the sink."
She headed over to it, opened the door, and snatched out the bottle.
Corinne grabbed her glass and started to pour.
"Suzanne Hope was maybe 25 years old. It was her first baby. You know how young mothers-to-be are, all glowing and over the top, happy, like they're the first people to ever get pregnant. Suzanne was really nice. We all talked to her about the pregnancy and the baby. You know, she'd tell us about her prenatal vitamins. She ran names by us. She didn't want to know if it was a boy or girl. She wanted to be surprised. Everyone liked her."
He bit back the sarcastic rejoinder. Instead, he replaced it with an obvious observation. "I thought you were there for quiet and reading."
"I was. I mean, that's how it started. But somewhere along the way, I started to cherish this social circle. I know it sounds pathetic, but I look forward to seeing these people. And it was like they only existed in that time and space, you know? It's like when you used to play pickup basketball. You loved those guys on the court, but you didn't know a thing about them off it. One guy owned that restaurant we went to, and you didn't even know, remember?
I remember, Corinne, but I don't see the point.
I'm just trying to explain. I made friends. People came in and out without warning. Like Jerry. One day Jerry disappeared. We assumed he got a job. But it's not like he came in and told us. He just stopped coming. Suzanne, too. We figured that she had the baby. She was way overdue. And then, sadly, when the new semester started, double lunch ended for me, and so I guess I faded away, too. That's how it worked. It was cyclical. The cast rotated.
He had no idea where she was going with this. But there was no reason to rush her, either. In a way, he wanted things to slow down now. He wanted to consider all options. He glanced back over at the kitchen table where Thomas and Ryan had just eaten and laughed and thought that they were secure. Corinne took a deep sip of her wine. To move it along, Adam asked, "Did you ever see any of them again?" Corinne almost smiled.
"That's the point of the story."
"What is?"
"I saw Suzanne again, maybe 3 months later."
"At Bookends?" She shook her head.
"No, it was a Starbucks in Ramsey."
"Did she have a boy or girl?"
A sad smile toyed with Corinne's lips.
"Neither." He didn't know what to make of that or how to follow it up, so he simply said, "Oh?" Corinne met his eye.
"She was pregnant."
"Suzanne was?"
"Yes."
"When you saw her at Starbucks?"
"Yes, except it was only 3 months after I last saw her, and she still looked 8 months pregnant."
Adam nodded, finally seeing where she was going.
"Which is, of course, impossible." "Of course."
"She was faking."
"Yes. See, I had to go to Ramsey to check out this new textbook. It was lunchtime again. Suzanne must have figured that there'd be no chance one of us from Bookends would be there. That Starbucks is, what, a 15-minute drive from Bookends?"
"At least."
"So, I was up at the counter ordering a latte, and I heard that voice, and there she was, sitting in the corner telling a rapt group of patrons about her prenatal vitamin regimen."
"I don't get it." Corinne tilted her head.
"Really?"
"You do?"
"Sure. I got it right away. Suzanne was holding court in the corner, and then I started walking toward her. When she spotted me, that glow just vanished. I mean, you can imagine. How do you explain being 8 months pregnant for, like, what, half a year? I just stood there and waited. I think she hoped that I'd leave, but I didn't. I was supposed to go to school, but later I told them I got a flat tire. Kristen covered my classes for me."
"You and Suzanne eventually talked?"
"Yes."
"And?"
"She said that she really lives in Nyack, New York."
That was about 30 minutes from both Bookends and that Starbucks, Adam figured.
"She told me a story about having a stillborn. I don't think it's true, but it could be. But in many ways, Suzanne's story is simpler. Some women love being pregnant. Not because of the hormonal rush or because they have a baby growing inside of them. Their reasons are much more base. It is the one time in their life they feel special. People hold doors for them. People ask them about their day. They ask them when they're due and how they're feeling. In short, they get attention. It's a little like being famous."
"Suzanne was nothing special to look at. She didn't strike me as being particularly smart or interesting. Being pregnant made her feel like a celebrity. It was like a drug." Adam shook his head. He remembered the wording on the fake a pregnancy website. "Nothing throws you in the spotlight like being pregnant."
"So she faked being pregnant in order to maintain the high."
"Yes.
She'd slap on the fake belly, she'd go to the coffee shop. Instant attention.
But there was only so long that she could get away with that, he said. You can't be 8 months pregnant for more than, well, a month or two.
Right, so she moved lunch spots. Who knows how long she'd been at it or if she's still doing it. She said her husband didn't care about her. He came home and went right to the TV or stayed at the bar with the guys. Again, I don't know if that's a lie. It doesn't matter. Oh, and Suzanne did it other places, too. Like instead of going to the supermarket in her hometown, she'd go to ones farther away and smile at people, and they'd always smile back. If she went to the movies and wanted a good seat, she'd use it. Same with airplane rides.
Wow, Adam said. That's pretty sick. But you don't get it?
I get it. She should see a shrink.
I don't know. It seems pretty harmless.
Strapping on a fake belly to gain attention?
Corinne shrugged. I admit it's extreme, but some people get attention because they're beautiful. Some because they inherited money or have a fancy job.
And some get it by lying about being pregnant, Adam said. Silence.
So I assume your friend Suzanne told you about the fake a pregnancy website.
She turned away.
Corinne? That's all I'm willing to say right now.
You're kidding, right?
No.
Wait, are you telling me you crave attention like this, Suzanne? I mean, this isn't normal behavior, you know that, right? This has to be a mental disorder of some kind.
I need to think about it.
Think about what?
It's late. I'm tired.
Are you out of your mind?
Stop.
What?
Corinne turned back to him. You feel it too, don't you, Adam?
What are you talking about?
We're in a minefield, she said. Like someone just dropped us right in the middle of it, and if we move too fast in any direction, we're going to step on an explosive and blow this whole thing up.
She looked at him. He looked at her. I didn't drop us in the minefield, he said through gritted teeth.
You did. I'm going up to bed. We can talk about this in the morning.
Adam blocked her path.
You're not going anywhere.
What are you going to do, Adam? Beat it out of me?
You owe me an explanation.
She shook her head.
You don't understand.
Don't understand what?
She looked up into his eyes. How did you find out, Adam?
It doesn't matter.
You have no idea how much it matters, she said in a soft voice. Who told you to look at the charge on the visa bill?
A stranger, he said. She took a step back.
Who?
I don't know. Some guy. I'd never seen him before. He came up to me at the American Legion and told me what you'd done.
She shook her head as though trying to clear it. I don't understand. What guy?
I just told you. A stranger.
We need to think about this, she said.
No, you need to tell me what's going on.
Not tonight.
She put her hands on his shoulders. He backed away as though her touch scalded him.
It isn't what you think, Adam. There's more to this.
Mom?
Adam spun toward the voice. Ryan stood at the top of the steps.
Can one of you help me with my math?
He asked. Corinne didn't hesitate. The smile was back in place.
I'll be right up, honey.
She turned to Adam.
Tomorrow?
She whispered to him. There was a pleading in her voice.
The stakes are so high, please. Just give me until tomorrow.
Chapter 10. What could he do? Corinne simply shut down. Later, alone in their bedroom, he tried anger, pleading, demanding, threats. He used words of love, ridicule, shame, pride. She wouldn't respond. It was so frustrating. At midnight, Corinne carefully took off the anniversary diamond studs and placed them on her night table. She turned off the lights, wished him a good night, and closed her eyes. He was at a loss. He came close, maybe too close, to doing something physical. He debated ripping off her covers. But what would that do? He wanted to, dare he even admit it to himself, put his hands on her to shake her and make her talk, or at least see reason. But when Adam was 12, he had seen his father put his hands on his mother. Mom had egged him on. That was how she was, sadly. She would call him names or insult his manhood until eventually he cracked. One night, he saw his father wrap his hands around his mother's neck and start to choke her. Oddly enough, it wasn't so much the fear, horror, and danger of seeing his father use force against his mother that bothered him. It was how pitiful and weak this act of dominance made his father look. How, even though she was on the receiving end, his mother had manipulated his father into becoming something so pathetic that he had to resort to doing something so out of character, so not him. Adam could never lay a hand on a woman, not just because it was wrong, but because of what it would do to him. Unsure what to do, he slipped into bed next to Corinne. He pounded his pillow into the right shape, laid his head on it, and closed his eyes. He gave it 10 minutes. No way. He headed downstairs, pillow in hand, and tried to sleep on the couch. He set his alarm for 5 a.m. so he'd be sure to get back upstairs into his bedroom before the boys woke up. There was no need. If sleep paid any visit, it was too brief to register. Corinne was deep in sleep when he went back up. He knew by her breathing that this wasn't an act. She was out cold. Funny that. He couldn't sleep. She could. He remembered reading somewhere that cops could often tell guilt or innocence by suspects who slept. An innocent man left alone in an interrogation room, the theory went, stayed awake because of confusion and nerves about being falsely accused. A guilty man fell asleep. Adam had never bought the theory, one of those things that sounds cute but doesn't really hold up, yet here he was, the innocent guy staying awake while his wife, the guilty, slept like a newborn. Adam was tempted to shake her awake, catch her in that cusp between dream and consciousness, maybe get the groggy truth out of her. But he had come to the conclusion that it wouldn't work. She had a point about being careful. But more than that, she was going to work in her own time frame. He couldn't push it too much. And maybe that was best. The question was, what was he going to do now? He knew the truth, didn't he? Did he really have to wait for her to confirm that she'd faked a pregnancy and a miscarriage? If she hadn't, he would have heard the denials by now. She was stalling, perhaps to come up with a reasonable rationale, or perhaps to give him time to calm down and consider his alternatives. Because what could he do here? Was he ready to walk out the door? Was he ready to divorce her? He didn't know the answer. Adam stood over the bed and stared down at her. How did he feel about her? He told himself, right now, without thinking about it, answer this. If it was true, did he still love her and want to be with her for the rest of his life? His feelings were jumbled, but his gut reaction, yes. Take a step back. How big a deal was this deception? It was huge. No question about it. Huge. But was it something that should destroy their lives, or was it something that they could live with? All families ignore the elephants in the room. Could he one day ignore this one? He didn't know. Which was why he would have to be careful. He would have to wait. He would have to listen to her reasoning, even if that seemed almost obscene to him. It isn't what you think, Adam. There's more to this. That was what Corinne said, but he couldn't imagine what. He slipped under the covers and closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them again, it was 3 hours later. Exhaustion had sneaked up on him and dragged him down. He checked the bed next to him. Empty. He swung his legs out of bed, his feet landing on the floor with a dull thud. From downstairs, he heard Thomas's voice. Thomas, the talker. Ryan, the listener. And Corinne? He glanced out the bedroom window. Her minivan was still in the driveway. He crept quietly down the stairs. He probably couldn't articulate exactly why, probably something to do with sneaking up on Corinne before she had a chance to leave for work. The boys were at the table. Corinne had made Adam his favorite. She was big on making favorites all of a sudden, wasn't she? A bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich on a sesame bagel. Ryan was eating a bowl of Reese's Puffs, health food, reading the back of the box as though it were religious scripture. Hey, guys. Two grunts. Whatever their personalities might be like later in the day, neither boy was big on preschool conversation with his parents. Where's your mother? Two shrugs. He stepped fully into the kitchen and looked out the window and into the backyard. Corinne was out there. Her back was turned. A phone was pressed up to her ear. Adam felt his face redden. When he pulled open the back door, Corinne spun toward him and put up a wait-a-sec finger. He didn't. He stormed toward her. She hung up the phone and slipped it into her pocket. Who's that?
The school.
Bullshit. Let me see the phone.
Adam?
He put out his hand. Give it to me.
Don't make a scene in front of the boys.
Cut the crap, Corinne. I want to know what's going on.
There's no time. I have to be at school in 10 minutes. Do you mind driving the boys?
Are you for real?
She stepped close to him. I can't tell you what you want to know yet.
He almost punched her. He almost reared back his fist and... What's your strategy here, Corinne?
What's yours?
Huh?
What's your worst-case scenario, she asked. Think about it. And if it's true, are you going to leave us?
Us?
You know what I mean.
It took a second for him to get the words out. I can't live with someone I can't trust, he said. She tilted her head.
And you don't trust me?
He said nothing.
We all have our secrets, don't we? Even you, Adam.
I've never kept anything like this from you. But clearly I have my answer.
No, you don't.
She moved close to him and looked up into his eyes.
You will soon, I promise.
He bit back and said, When?
Let's meet for dinner tonight. Janice's Bistro at 7, back table. We can talk there.
Chapter 11. Hummel figurines sat on the top shelf. There was a little girl with a donkey, three children playing follow the leader, a little boy with a beer stein, and finally a boy pushing a girl on a swing.
Eunice loves them, the old man told Adam. Me? I can't stand the damn things. They creep me out. I keep thinking someone should make a horror film with them, you know? Like instead of that scary clown or leprechaun. Can you imagine if those things came to life?
The kitchen was old wood paneling. A Viva Las Vegas magnet was on the fridge. There was a snow globe with three pink flamingos on the ledge above the sink. The mounting read Miami, Florida, in a florid script font. FLA, in case you weren't sure which Miami, Adam guessed. The Wizard of Oz collectible plates and an owl clock with moving eyes took up the wall on the right. The wall on the left had numerous, yet fading, police-related certificates and plaques. A retrospective of the long and distinguished career of retired Lieutenant Colonel Michael Rinsky. Rinsky noticed Adam reading the certificates and muttered,
Eunice insisted we hang them up.
She's proud of you, Adam said.
Yeah, whatever.
Adam turned back toward him. So, tell me about the mayor's visit.
Mayor Rick Gusharowski. Busted him twice when he was in high school, once for drunk driving.
Was he charged?
Just called his old man to pick him up. This was, what, 30 years ago? We did that more back in those days. Considered drunk driving a minor offense. Stupid.
Adam nodded to let him know that he was listening.
They're real strict with the drunk driving stuff now. Saves lives. But anyway, Rick comes to my door. Mr. Mayor now. Got the suit with the American flag in the lapel. Don't join the military. Don't help out the little guy.
Don't take in your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. But if you wear a little flag, you're a patriot.
Adam tried not to smile.
So Rick comes in with this chest out and this big grin. The developers are offering you a lot of money, he says to me. Goes on and on about how generous they're being.
What did you say?
Nothing yet. I just kind of stared at him. Let him bloviate.
He signaled to the kitchen table for them to sit. Adam didn't want to send in Eunice his chair. It felt wrong somehow, so he asked,
which chair?
And he's fine.
Adam took one.
Then Rinsky sat. The vinyl tablecloth was old and a little sticky and felt just right. There were still five chairs here, though the three boys he and Eunice had raised in this very house were grown and gone.
Then he starts in on me with the good of the community stuff. You're standing in the way of progress, he tells me. People will lose their jobs because of you. Crime will increase. You know the deal.
I do, yes, Adam said. Adam had heard it before many times, and he wasn't unsympathetic. Over the years, this downtown neighborhood had gone to seed. Some developer getting a ton of tax breaks had come in and bought up every building on the block on the cheap. He wanted to knock down all the dilapidated homes, apartments, storefronts, and build shiny new condos and Gap stores and Tony restaurants. It wasn't a bad idea, really. You could make fun of the gentrification, but towns needed new blood, too.
So he keeps talking about the shiny new Castleton, how it will make the neighborhood safe and bring people back and all that. Then he comes up with his big pot sweetener. The developer has new senior living housing in the Heights. And then he has the gall to lean across and give me the sad eyes and say, you need to think about Eunice.
Wow, Adam said.
I know, right? Then he says I should take this deal because the next one will be worse. And they can throw me out.
Can they really do that?
They can, Adam said. We bought this house in 1970 off my GI Bill. Eunice, she's fine, but sometimes her mind isn't on the track it's supposed to be. So she gets real scared in strange places. She starts to cry and shake, even. But then she gets home, right? She sees this kitchen. She sees her creepy figurines or that rusty old refrigerator, and she's okay again. Do you understand?
I do.
Can you help us?
Adam leaned back.
Oh, yes, I think I can.
Rinsky studied him for a few moments, his eyes penetrating. Adam shifted in the chair. He could tell what a great cop he must have been.
You've got a funny look on your face, Mr. Price.
Call me Adam. What kind of funny look?
I'm an old cop, remember?
Of course.
I pride myself on reading faces.
And what are you seeing on mine? Adam asked.
That you're cooking up a badass killer idea.
I may be, Adam said. I think I can end this quickly if you have the stomach for it. The old man smiled.
Do I look like I'm afraid of a fight?
Chapter 12. When Adam got home at 6 p.m., Corinne's car wasn't in the driveway. He didn't know whether that surprised him. Corinne was usually home before him, but she probably wisely figured that there might be a scene if they met up at home before their Janice's Bistro dinner, so it would be best to avoid him. He hung up his coat and placed his briefcase in the corner. The boys' backpacks and sweatshirts were strewn across the floor as though they were debris from a plane crash.
Hello? He shouted. Thomas? Ryan?
No answer. There was a time in this world when that meant something. Maybe it was even a cause of concern. But with the video games and the headphones and the teenage boys' constant need to shower, was that a euphemism, any concern was short-lived. He started up the stairs. Sure enough, the shower was running, probably Thomas. The door to Ryan's room was closed. Adam gave it a brief knuckle rap, but opened without waiting for a response. If the headphones were loud enough, Ryan might never reply. If he just opened it, he felt as though he was completely invading his son's privacy. The knock and open somehow felt like a parentally fair way to handle the dilemma. As expected, Ryan was lying in bed with his headphones on, fiddling with his iPhone. He slipped them off and sat up.
Hey?
Hey.
What's for dinner?
Ryan asked. Good, thanks. Work was busy. Sure, but overall, yeah, I'd say I had an okay day. How about you?
Ryan just stared at his father.
Ryan often just stared at his father.
Have you seen your mother?
Adam asked.
No.
She and I are going to Janice's tonight. You want me to order you two a pizza from Pizzola? There are a few questions more rhetorical than asking your child whether they want you to order them pizza for dinner.
Ryan didn't even bother with the yes, heading straight to the can we get buffalo chicken topping.
Your brother likes pepperoni, Adam said.
So I'll go half and half.
Ryan frowned.
What? Just one pie?
It's only the two of you.
Ryan did not seem placated. If that's not enough, there are chipwiches in the freezer for dessert, Adam said. That okay?
Grudgingly.
I guess.
Adam headed back down the hall and into his bedroom. He sat on the bed and called the pizzeria, adding an order of mozzarella sticks. Feeding teenage boys was like filling a bathtub with a grapefruit spoon. Corinne was always complaining, happily for the most part, that she had to food shop every other day at the least.
Hey, Dad.
Thomas wore a towel around his waist. Water dripped from his hair. He smiled and said,
What's for dinner?
I just ordered you guys pizza.
Pepperoni?
Half pepperoni, half buffalo chicken. Adam held up his hand before Thomas could say more. And an order of mozzarella sticks. Thomas gave his father a thumbs up.
Nice.
You don't have to eat it all, just leave the leftovers in the fridge. Thomas made a confused face.
What is this leftovers of which you speak?
Adam shook his head and chuckled.
Did you leave me any hot water?
Some.
Great.
Adam normally wouldn't shower and change, but he had time and felt oddly nervous. He showered quickly, managing to stay seconds ahead of the hot water, and shaved away the Homer Simpson 5 o'clock shadow. He reached into the back of his cabinet and pulled out an aftershave he knew Corinne liked. He hadn't worn it in a while. Why he hadn't worn it recently, he couldn't say. Why he had chosen to wear it tonight, he couldn't say either. He put on a blue shirt because Corinne used to say that blue worked with his eyes. He felt stupid about that and almost changed. But then he figured, what the hell? When he started out the bedroom door, he turned around and took a long look at this room that had been theirs for so long. The king-size bed was neatly made. There were too many pillows on it. When had people started putting so many pillows on a bed? But he and Corinne had spent a lot of years here. A simple and insipid thought, but there you go. It was just a room, just a bed. Yet a voice in Adam's head couldn't help but wonder. Depending on how this dinner went, he and Corinne might never spend another night in here together. That was melodramatic, of course, pure hyperbole. But if hyperbole couldn't feel free to roam in his head, where could it roam? The doorbell rang. No movement from the boys. There never was. They had been trained somehow to never answer the house phone. It wasn't for them, after all. And to never answer the doorbell. It was usually a delivery guy. As soon as Adam paid and closed the door, the boys clumped down the stairs like runaway Clydesdales. The house shook, but held its ground.
Paper plates okay? Thomas asked.
Thomas and Ryan would eat on paper plates exclusively because it meant easier cleanup. But tonight, with the parents away, it was pretty much a given that if he forced real plates on them, they'd be in the sink when he and Corinne came home. Corinne would then complain to Adam. Adam would then have to scream for the boys to come down and put their plates in the dishwasher. The boys would claim that they were just about to do it. Yeah, right. But not to worry because they'd be down and do it when their show was over in 5:15 minutes. 5:15 minutes would pass, and then Corinne would complain to Adam again about how irresponsible the boys were, and he'd shout up to them with a little more anger in his voice. The cycles of domesticity. Paper plates are fine, Adam said. The two boys attacked the pizza as if they were rehearsing the finale of The Day of the Locust. Between bites, Ryan looked at his father curiously.
What?
Adam said.
Ryan managed to swallow. I thought you were just going to Janice's for dinner.
We are.
So what's with the getup?
It isn't a getup.
And what's the smell? Thomas added. Are you wearing cologne?
Ew, it's ruining the taste of the pizza.
Knock it off, Adam said.
Want to trade a slice of pepperoni for a slice of buffalo chicken?
No.
Come on, just one slice.
Throw in a mozzarella stick.
No way, half a mozzarella stick.
Adam started for the door as the negotiations wore down. We won't be late. Get your homework done, and please stick the pizza box in the recycling, okay?
He drove past the new hot yoga place on Franklin Avenue. By hot, he meant temperature of the class, not popularity or looks, and found parking across the street from Janice's. 5 minutes early. He looked for Corinne's car. No sign of it, but she could be parked in the back lot.
David, Janice's son, and quasi-maitre d' greeted him at the door and brought him to the back table. No Corinne. Well, okay, he was here first. No big deal.
Janice came out of the kitchen 2 minutes later.
Adam rose and kissed her on the cheek.
Where's your wine? Janice asked.
Her bistro was BYO. Adam and Corinne always brought a bottle.
Forgot.
Maybe Corinne will bring some?
I doubt it.
I can send David to Carlo Russo's.
Carlo Russo's was the wine store down the street.
That's okay.
It's no hassle. It's quiet right now.
David!
Janice turned back to Adam.
What are you having tonight?
Probably the veal Milanese.
David, get Adam and Corinne a bottle of the Paradox X blend.
David brought back the wine. Corinne still wasn't there. David opened the bottle and poured two glasses. Corinne still wasn't there. At 7:15, Adam started to get that sinking feeling in his gut. He texted Corinne, no answer. At 7:30, Janice came over to him and asked if everything was okay. He assured her that it was, that Corinne was probably just caught up in some parent-teacher conference. Adam stared at his phone, willing it to buzz. At 7:45 p.m., it did. It was a text from Corinne.
Maybe we need some time apart. You take care of the kids. Don't try to contact me. It will be okay.
Then, just give me a few days.
Please.
Chapter 13. Adam sent several desperate texts to try to get Corinne to reply. They included, "This isn't the way to handle this. Please call me. Where are you? How many days? How can you do this to us?" Stuff like that. He tried nice, mean, calm, angry, but there was no reaction. Was Corinne okay? He gave Janice some lame excuse about Corinne still being stuck and having to cancel. Janice insisted that he take two veal Milanese home with him. He was going to fight it, but there seemed little point. As he pulled onto his street, he still held out hope that Corinne had changed her mind and gone home. It was one thing to be mad at him. It was another thing to take it out on the boys. But her car wasn't in the drive, and the first thing Ryan said to him when he opened the door was, "Where's Mom?"
"She has some work thing," Adam said in a voice equally vague and dismissive.
"I need my home uniform."
"So?"
"So I threw it in the wash. Do you know if Mom did the laundry?"
"No," Adam said. "Why don't you check the basket?"
"I did."
"How about your drawers?"
"I checked there too."
"You always see your or your spouse's flaws in your child."
Ryan had Corinne's anxiety over small matters. Big matters, house payments, illness, destruction, accidents, didn't bother Corinne. She rose to the occasion, maybe because she overcompensated by worrying the minor stuff into a ground stump. Or maybe, in life, like a great athlete, Corinne was clutch when it mattered. Of course, to be fair, this was no small matter to Ryan.
"Then maybe it's in the washer or dryer," Adam said.
"Already looked."
"Then I don't know what to tell you, kid."
"When will Mom be home?" I don't know.
Like at 10?
What part of I don't know is confusing you exactly?
There was more snap in his tone than expected. Ryan was also, like his mother, super sensitive.
I didn't mean... I'll text Mom.
That's a good idea.
Oh, let me know what she says, okay?
Ryan nodded and texted. Corinne didn't reply to him right away, nor in an hour, or even two. Adam made up some excuse about her teacher's conference being extended. The boys bought it because boys never looked too closely at stuff like that. He promised Ryan that he'd find the uniform before his game. Adam was, of course, blocking to some extent. Was Corinne safe? Had something terrible happened to her? Should he go to the police? The last part felt foolish. The police would hear about their big fight, see Corinne's text about letting her be, and shake their heads. And really, when you step back, is it so bizarre that his wife would want a little distance after what Adam had just learned? Sleep came in small chunks. Adam constantly checked his phone for texts from Corinne. Nothing. At 3 a.m., he sneaked into Ryan's room and checked his son's phone. Nothing. This made no sense. Trying to avoid Adam? Okay, he could get that. She might be angry or scared or confused or feeling cornered. It would make sense that she might want to get away from him for a few days. But her boys? Would Corinne really just up and leave her boys in the lurch like this? Did she expect him to just make excuses? You take care of the kids. Don't try to contact me. What was that all about? Why shouldn't he try to contact her? And what about...
He sat up as the sun came through the windows.
Hello. Corinne could abandon him. She could even want to, he didn't know, force him to take care of the boys. But what about her students? She took her teaching responsibilities, like most things that mattered, very seriously. She was also a bit of a control freak and hated the idea of some ill-prepared substitute taking over her class for even a day. Funny, now that he thought about it. Over the past 4 years, Corinne had missed only one day of school. The day after her miscarriage. It had been a Thursday. He had come home late from work to find her crying in bed. When the bad cramping started, she had driven herself to the doctor. It was too late. But in truth, she said the doctor wouldn't have been able to do anything anyway. These things happen, the doctor had told her.
Why didn't you call me? Adam had asked.
I didn't want you to worry or rush home. There was nothing you could do. And he had bought it. Corinne had wanted to go to work the next day, but Adam put his foot down. She had gone through something traumatic. You don't just get up and go to work the next day. He had picked up the phone and handed it to her. Call the school. Tell them you won't be in. She had reluctantly made the call, informing the school that she would be back by Monday. Adam had thought at the time that this was simply Corinne's way. Get back to life. Get back to work. No reason to dwell. He had been amazed at the speed of her recovery.
Man, how naive could one man be?
But then again, was that his fault? Who the hell would be looking for dishonesty in such a traumatic moment? Why would he question her word on something so serious? Even now, with hindsight, he had no idea why Corinne would have done something so heinous, crazy, desperate, manipulative.
What?
But that didn't matter right now. The point was, Corinne would be at school. She might choose to take time off from him and maybe even her boys, but there was no reason why she wouldn't be at school today. The boys were old enough to get ready for school on their own. Adam managed to avoid them, ducking their questions about Mom's whereabouts with quick shout-outs from his bedroom and the pretense of a long morning shower. When the boys were gone, he drove over to the high school. The bell for homeroom would have just sounded. That would be perfect. Adam could enter and confront her as she walked between homeroom and first period. Her homeroom class was room 233. He would wait for her by the door.
The high school had been built in the 70s and reeked of it. What had been considered sleek and modern had weathered like an old sci-fi movie set, like Logan's Run or something. The building was gray with fading aqua trim. It was the edificial equivalent of Cheese Whiz or a hockey player's mullet. There were no free spaces in the school's parking lot. Adam ended up parking illegally, live on the edge, and hurrying toward the school. The side door was locked. Adam had never done this before, visited Corinne during a school day. But he knew that all schools had taken up stringent security protocols in the wake of shootings and other violence. He circled toward the front door. It was also locked. Adam pressed the intercom button. A camera whirred down on him, and the weary female voice that could only belong to someone working in a school's main office asked him who he was. He put on his most disarming smile. "It's Adam Price, Corinne's husband." The door buzzed. Adam pushed through the doors. A sign read, "Check in at the main desk." He wasn't sure what to do here. If he signed in, they would want to know why and probably buzz down to the classroom. He didn't want that. He wanted to surprise Corinne, or at the very least, not need to explain to the staff why he was here. The office was on the right. Adam was about to turn left and just hurry down the opposite way when he saw the armed security guard. He aimed his most disarming smile at the guard. The guard offered one back. No choice now. He'd have to go to the main office. He veered through the door and weaved past a few local moms. There was a huge laundry basket in the middle of the floor where parents dropped off lunches for the kids who forgot to bring them in the morning. The clock on the wall grunted and ticked. It read 8:17 a.m. 3 minutes until the bell rang. Okay. Good. The sign-up sheet was on the tall counter. He picked up the pen as casually as possible. "Mr. Without a Care," and quickly signed in with intentionally messy handwriting. He grabbed a visitor pass. The two women behind the desk were busy. They didn't bother to even glance his way. No reason to wait, was there? He hurried back down the hall, flashing his visitor pass at the guard. Like most high schools, there had been additions over the years, and that helped make traversing your way inside these arteries somewhat tricky. Still, when the bell sounded, Adam was perfectly situated to observe the door to room 233. The students streamed out and collided and clogged the corridors like some medical documentary on heart disease. He waited until the flow of students petered out and then halted. Then, a few seconds later, a young man Adam guessed was probably under 30 came out and turned left. A substitute. Adam just stood there, pressing himself against the wall to let the student stream rush past him and not get caught in its current. He wasn't sure what to think or do. Was he even surprised by this development? He didn't know. He tried to put it together. He tried to think about the links here. The fake pregnancy, the stranger, the confrontation that had led to his wife's choosing to run off for a few days. It made no sense. So, what next? Nothing, he supposed. At least not right this very moment. Go to work, do your job, think it through. He was missing something. He knew that. Corinne had as much as admitted that, hadn't she? "It isn't what you think, Adam. There's more to this." When the flow of students turned into a trickle, he started back toward the front exit. He was lost in thought and about to make a turn when he felt fingers like a steel talon grip his arm. He turned and saw his wife's friend, Kristen Hoy. "What the hell is going on?" she whispered. "What?" Her muscles clearly were not just for show. She pulled him into an empty chemistry classroom and closed the door. There were workstations and beakers and sinks with high faucets, a giant chart of the periodic table of elements. Both a staple of every science classroom and a cliché dominated the far wall. "Where is she?" Kristen asked. Adam wasn't sure how to play it, so he went with honesty. "I don't know." "How can you not know?" "We were supposed to meet for dinner last night. She never showed." "She just didn't..." Kristen shook her head in confusion. "Did you call the police?" "What? No." "Why not? I don't know. She sent a text. She said she needed some time away.
From what?
Adam just looked at her. Kristen said, you?
Seems so.
Oh, sorry.
Kristen stepped back, chastened. So why are you here?
Because I want to make sure she's okay. I figured she'd be at work. She never calls in sick.
Never,
Kristen agreed.
Except, it seems, today.
Kristen considered that.
I guess you guys have been fighting a lot?
Adam didn't really want to get into it.
But what choice did he have?
Something has recently come up, he said in his most noncommittal legal voice.
It isn't any of my business, right?
All right.
But it's kind of my business because Corinne made it part of my business.
What do you mean? Kristen sighed and put her hand to her mouth.
Outside the school, her outfits were all about accentuating her toned body. She wore sleeveless blouses and either shorts or small skirts, even when the weather didn't exactly call for it. In here, her blouse was more conservative, though you could still see the muscles near the clavicle and neck.
I got a text too, she said.
What did it say?
Adam?
What?
I don't want to get in the middle of this. You get that, right? You two have been having issues. I get that.
We haven't been having issues.
But you just said
we have an issue, one, and, well, it just came up.
When?
When did the issue come up?
Yes.
The day before yesterday?
Oh,
Kristen said.
What do you mean, oh?
It's just that, I mean, Corinne has been acting strangely for the past month or so.
Adam tried to keep a straight face.
Strange how?
Just, I don't know, different, distracted. She missed a class or two and asked me to cover for her. She missed a few workouts and said,
Kristen stopped.
Said what?
Adam prodded.
Said if anybody asked where she was, to just say that she was there with me.
Silence.
Did she mean me, Kristen?
She never said that, no.
Look, I better get back. I have class.
Adam stepped in her path.
What did her text say?
What?
You said she sent you a text yesterday. What did it say?
Look, she's my friend. You get that, right?
I'm not asking you to betray confidences.
Yeah, Adam, you kinda are.
I just want to make sure she's okay.
Why wouldn't she be?
Because this isn't like her.
Maybe it's just what she said to you. She needs time.
Is that what she texted you?
Something like that, yes.
When?
Yesterday afternoon.
Wait, when? After school?
No, Kristen said too slowly.
During.
During school?
Yes.
What time?
I don't know, around 2 o'clock.
Wasn't she at school?
No.
She missed school yesterday, too?
No, Kristen said. I saw Corinne in the morning. She was acting a little shaky.
I guess that's because you guys were fighting.
Adam said nothing.
She was supposed to oversee study hall during lunch break, but she asked me to cover for her. I did. I saw her run out to her car.
Where was she going?
I don't know. She didn't say.
Silence.
Did she come back to school?
Kristen shook her head.
No, Adam. She never came back.
Chapter 14. The stranger had given Heidi the link to findyoursugarbaby.com as well as her daughter's user ID and password. With a heavy heart, Heidi signed in as Kimberly and found out all she needed to confirm that everything the stranger had told her was true. The stranger had not just told her out of the kindness or emptiness of his heart. He made money demands, of course. 10 grand was the amount. If she didn't pay it in 3 days, the news of Kimberly's hobby would go viral. Heidi signed out and sat on the couch. She debated pouring herself a glass of wine and decided against it. Then Heidi had a good, long cry. When she finished, she headed to the bathroom, washed her face, and sat back on the couch. Okay, she thought. What do I do about this?
Heidi's first decision was almost the simplest. Don't tell Marty. She didn't like to keep secrets from her husband, but then again, she didn't hate it either. It was part of life, wasn't it? Marty would absolutely lose it if he found out what his little girl was up to while she was supposedly studying at NYU. Marty was prone to overreaction, and Heidi could see him hopping in his car, driving to Manhattan and dragging his daughter back by the hair. Marty didn't need to know the truth. Come to think of it, neither did Heidi.
Damn those two strangers.
When Kimberly was in high school, she had gotten drunk at a party at a classmate's house. Intoxication led, as it often does, to going a little too far with a boy. Not all the way, but too far. Another mother in town, a busybody who meant well, had overheard her daughter talking about the incident. She had called Heidi and said, "I hate to tell you this, but if our roles were reversed, I would want to know." So she told Heidi about the incident. Heidi had told Marty, who had completely overreacted. The relationship between father and daughter had never really been the same. What, Heidi wondered, would have been the outcome if that busybody had never called? In the end, what good had it done? It embarrassed her daughter. It strained the relationship between father and daughter. It had, Heidi believed, been a huge part of Kimberly's decision to go to college so far away. And maybe that stupid phone call from that stupid busybody had even led Kimberly and ultimately Heidi to this terrible website and the horrific nature of her daughter's relationship with three different men. Heidi didn't want to believe it, but the evidence was right there in the secret communications between her young daughter and these older men. Dress it up all she wanted, but there was no way around the fact that her daughter was involved in straight-up prostitution. She wanted to cry again. She wanted to do nothing and forget those two calm strangers had ever said anything to her. But she had no choice now, did she? The secret had been thrust in her face. She couldn't put that horse back in the barn, to mix her metaphors. It was a parental paradox, probably as old as time. She didn't want to know. But she did want to know. When she called her daughter's cell phone, Kimberly had answered with breathless enthusiasm.
"Hi, Mom."
"Hi, sweetheart. Everything okay? Your voice sounds funny." At first, Kimberly had denied it. That was to be expected. Then she tried to make it sound innocent. That, too, was to be expected. Then Kimberly tried defiance, accusing her mother of hacking into her account and invading her privacy. Again, expected. Heidi kept her voice steady even as her heart cracked in her chest and filled it with pain. She explained to Kimberly about the stranger. She recounted what they had told her and what she had seen on her own. Patiently, calmly, at least on the outside. It took some time, but they both knew where this conversation was headed. Cornered, the shock slowly wearing off, Kimberly started to open up. "Money was tight," she explained. "You can't believe how expensive everything is here." A classmate had told Kimberly about the site. You didn't really have to do anything with the guys, she'd been told. They just wanted young girls for the company. Heidi almost laughed out loud at that one. Men, as Heidi knew all too well and Kimberly quickly learned, never really just wanted company. That was merely the loss leader to get you in the store. Heidi and Kimberly talked for 2 hours. At the end of the conversation, Kimberly asked her mother what she should do. "Break it off with them, today, now." Kimberly promised she would do just that. The next question was how to proceed. Heidi said she would take some time off and come up and spend some time in New York. Kimberly balked.
"The semester will be over in 2 weeks. Let's just wait till then."
Heidi didn't like that idea. In the end, they agreed to discuss it further in the morning. Before they hung up, Kimberly said,
"Mom?"
"Yes?"
"Please don't tell Dad."
Already decided, but she didn't tell Kimberly that. When Marty came home, she said nothing. Marty cooked up burgers on the grill in the yard. Heidi poured them both drinks. He talked about his day, she talked about hers.
The secret was there, of course. It sat at the kitchen table in Kimberly's old chair, never speaking, but never budging either. In the morning, after Marty left for work, there was a knock on the door.
Who is it?
Mrs. Dan, I'm Detective John Kuntz, the New York Police Department. May I speak with you? Heidi threw open the door, nearly collapsing in the process.
Oh, my God, my daughter!
Oh, she's fine, ma'am, Kuntz said quickly, stepping forward to help support her. Wow, geez, I'm sorry, I guess I should have told you that right away. I'm just imagining your daughter is in school in New York and an NYPD officer shows up at your door. Kuntz shook his head. I have kids, too. I get it. But don't worry, Kimberly's fine. I mean, health-wise. There are other factors.
Factors?
Kuntz smiled. There was a little too much space between each tooth. He sported a terrible comb-over, the kind of thing that made you want to grab a pair of scissors, pull the few hairs taut, and snip them off. She placed him in his mid-40s, paunchy with stooped shoulders and the sunken eyes of someone who didn't eat well or get enough sleep. May I come in for a moment? Kuntz held up his badge. It looked to Heidi's amateur eye to be legitimate.
What's this about?
I think you probably have some idea. Kuntz nodded toward the door.
May I?
Heidi stepped back.
I don't.
Don't what?
Have any idea what this is about?
Kuntz stepped inside and looked around as though he were there to buy the place. He smoothed down a few of the comb-over hairs that had started to make a static electrical escape.
Well, you called your daughter last night, is that correct?
Heidi wasn't sure how to answer. Didn't matter. Kuntz plowed ahead without waiting for one anyway.
We are aware that your daughter has been involved in activity that could be illegal.
What do you mean? He sat on the couch. She sat on the chair across from him.
Can I ask a favor, Mrs. Dan?
What's that?
It's a small one, but I think it would really simplify this conversation for all concerned. Let's stop with the pretense, okay? It just wastes time.
Your daughter, Kimberly, was involved in online prostitution. Heidi just sat there.
Mrs. Dan, I think you better leave.
I'm trying to help.
It sounds like you're making accusations. I better talk to an attorney.
Kuntz pushed down the stray strands again.
You got it wrong.
How so?
We don't care about what your daughter may or may not have done. It's petty, and I will grant you this. With the online stuff, there is a fine line between business, relationship, and prostitution. Then again, maybe there has always been. We aren't interested in hassling you or your daughter.
Then what do you want? Heidi asked.
Your cooperation. That's all. If you and Kimberly cooperate, we see no reason why we can't just forget about her role in all this.
Her role in what?
Let's take it a step at a time, shall we?
Kuntz reached into his pocket and pulled out a small pad. Then he took out one of those small pencils golfers use to keep score. He licked the pencil's tip and turned his attention back toward Heidi.
First off, how did you find out about your daughter's involvement with that sugar baby's website?
What difference does that make?
Kuntz shrugged. Just a routine question.
Heidi said nothing. The small tingling at the base of her neck had started to grow.
Mrs. Dan, I think I better talk to an attorney.
Oh, Kuntz said. He made a face as though he were a teacher, suddenly disappointed by a favorite pupil.
Then your daughter lied to us.
Oh, that won't look good here. I gotta be honest. Heidi knew that he wanted her to bite. The silence between them grew so big Heidi could barely breathe. She couldn't take it. So she asked,
Why do you think my daughter lied?
Simple. Kimberly told us you found out about the website in a completely legal way. She said that two people, a man and a woman, stopped you outside a restaurant and informed you of what was going on. But see, if that were true, I don't get why you wouldn't want to tell us that. There is nothing illegal in that activity. Heidi's head started spinning.
I don't understand any of this. What are you doing here exactly?
That's a fair question, I guess. Kuntz sighed and adjusted himself on the couch.
Do you know what the cybercrime unit is?
I imagine it has something to do with crimes on the internet.
Exactly. I'm with the CCU. That stands for the cybercrime unit, which is a fairly new division of the NYPD. We bust criminals who use the internet in nefarious ways. Hackers, scammers, that kind of thing. And we suspect that the person or persons who approached you at the restaurant are part of an elusive cyber criminal syndicate we've been after for a long time.
Heidi swallowed.
I see. And we would like your help in finding and identifying whoever might have been involved in these crimes.
Does that make sense?
So, let's get back to it, okay?
Yes or no, did two people approach you in the parking lot of a restaurant?
The tingling was still there, but she said, yes.
Great. Kuntz smiled with the spaced teeth again. He wrote something down and looked back up at her.
What restaurant?
She hesitated.
Mrs. Dan.
I don't understand something, Heidi said slowly.
What's that, ma'am?
I just talked to my daughter yesterday afternoon.
Yes.
So, when did you talk to her?
Last night.
And how did you get here so fast?
This matter is of great importance to us. I flew in this morning.
But how did you even know about it?
Pardon?
My daughter didn't say anything about calling the police, so how would you know? She stopped. Her mind traveled down a few possible paths. All of them were pretty dark.
Mrs. Dan,
I think you better leave.
Kuntz nodded.
He started working the few strands of hair again, sweeping them from one ear to the other. Then he said,
I'm sorry, but I can't do that.
Heidi stood and moved toward the door.
I'm not going to talk to you.
Yes, you are. Still sitting and with something approaching a sigh, Kuntz took out his gun, aimed with precision at Heidi's kneecap, and pulled the trigger.